Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Elation yesterday after West Virginia's teachers won a 5% pay raise following their historic 9-day strike. Here's Danielle Harris, a teacher from Fayette County, West Virginia.
I feel like this is the right step that West Virginia needs to take for the education of our whole state. So far, we've been at the bottom for too long, and this finally gives us a boost to come up to the top. Our kids deserve teachers that are going to be well paid so that we can attract teachers from all over.
And now teachers in Arizona and Oklahoma are wondering if they should strike next. Those two states rank near the bottom of the nation when it comes to teacher pay. But the West Virginia teacher strike may have accomplished something just as important as raising salaries. It's forcing the nation to rethink who's economically vulnerable and why, and what that means for this country when teachers like Jacob Fertig have to rely on government assistance to get by.
As a professional degree teacher working two jobs, I qualified for WIC and food stamps, and we collected on the WIC. So that's how low teacher pay is here. You know, there were a lot of times where we had to choose between groceries and, you know, health coverage for my family.
This hour on Point, is there a crisis in teacher pay and lessons from West Virginia? You can join us on air or online. What lessons did you take from the strike in West Virginia? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org. Or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And a bit later this hour, we'll take a look at the brain drain from the White House. But first, let's spend a considerable amount of time talking about those lessons from West Virginia. Joining me now from Charleston, West Virginia, is Andrea Lanham. She's State House reporter for the Register Herald, and she's been covering the teacher strike and the deal that was just passed yesterday. Andrea, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, let me just check. Is everybody back in school today?
Yeah, I woke up this morning and saw the school closure map, and it was definitely a different scene because I was used to seeing every single county closed, and it looks like every county is open except for a few that were on a two-hour delay because they were experiencing some snow. But yeah, definitely a different scene.
Right, so a little bit of a storm to put an exclamation point at the end of this this 9-day historic strike. And what's the mood there in Charleston? This has been a kind of incredible week in a couple of days.
Yeah. What was really interesting yesterday is just how quickly the mood changed, because in the morning there was a lot of skepticism. There was a lot of, I would say, unrest, because just being in that conference committee meeting, a lot of people weren't very hopeful of seeing a resolution yesterday just because of everything that had happened the day before. Yesterday was the last day that the conference committee could reach a resolution without extending a day. So people just weren't very hopeful. But then as the day went on, you saw the mood start to become a little more cheerful. People were chanting, sign that bill. And then as soon as the Senate passed the bill, there were cheers in the gallery, which mm-hmm. doesn't usually happen.
Right. Now, this is something that I'll admit we're having a little trouble pinning down. So help us out, Andrea. I mean, it's a 5% pay raise for teachers, school service employees, and police officers. But what does that equate to in the actual number of dollars? How many millions of dollars is this for West Virginia?
You know, that's really hard to pin down to, because I know that it's a 5% average. But there's like different classifications, so I couldn't say like how that would break down in their individual paychecks. Now, one interesting thing to note too is that it's 5% for all state employees. However, they can't do that under the bill just because it's a different section of code. So they have to go in to the actual budget to do the other state employees. Now, the quote from yesterday that I was hearing, at least from the Senate Democrats, is that this 5% raise will basically give them the buying power that they would have had 4 years ago. So we're still not where a lot of people would want us to be as far as teacher pay, but it looks like we are getting there.
Right. And the reason why I ask is because, you know, in terms of the cost to the state of West Virginia, it makes a difference if it's $20 million, $50 million, $100 million overall. Because, I mean, we're seeing already, right, that there are folks in the legislature there. I'm looking at Mitch Carmichael, president of the state Senate, who's saying that the deal is probably going to lead to painful cuts in the other parts of the state budget, including Medicaid. I mean, how likely is that?
Yeah. Well, and this was another interesting thing about yesterday as well, because the governor kind of went back and forth of saying there's no way on this planet that Medicaid is going to get cut, but then saying there might be some reductions. And the Senate president told us last night that Medicaid will absolutely get cut. And he used a figure, I believe, of $10 million. And, of course, that's subject to a 3-to-1 federal match as well. But, I mean, it's just hard to say at this point with the governor kind of flip-flopping on that issue, but the Senate president saying that's what we have in mind. Now, whether the House would support something like that is hard to tell. And basically the reason behind that is the governor revised the estimate of $58 million, but the Senate decided they didn't want to use that, saying that they didn't believe that revised revenue estimate was valid.
So there's still obviously a big question mark then hanging over all of that. One last question for you, Andrea. I mean, we've talked about sort of how teachers have been feeling the work left to be done in the legislature. But overall, I mean, how do West Virginians feel about what's just happened in the state?
I think that just basically from everything that I've seen on social media and everything that people told me, they've seen a lot of unity with this because, I mean, it was a statewide walkout and the chants were 55 United. So just seeing that amount of unity throughout the state, that's one of the things that struck me and one of the things that people have mentioned to me even from out of state.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was definitely something to take away.
Well, Andrea Lanham is State House reporter for the Register Herald. She's been covering the West Virginia teachers strike. Andrea, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
All right, let's turn now to Dale Lee. He's joining us also from Charleston, West Virginia, and he's president of the West Virginia Education Association, one of the unions that represented the teachers who had been striking. Dale Lee, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
What is the most important thing you think the teachers have accomplished over the course of this strike?
The unity that we have, and this is really a win for the kids. Because for the first time, we are making an investment in education in West Virginia. Instead of funding education, we're making an investment in education. But you have to remember, this is just the first step. We can't do this now and then forget about it for the next 3 years. We have to make that investment. We have to start now. We have to continue that investment throughout the years.
Right. I mean, obviously, teachers were feeling incredibly passionately about this because it is a remarkable thing to have a statewide strike shutting schools down for 9 days. But, I'm wondering, what is your reaction to hearing members of the legislature, as I just talked about with Andrea, saying the pay raises may come at the cost of having to cut other parts of the budget? I mean, could this end up being a zero-sum game?
Well, first of all, let me clear one thing up. They are taking some money from Medicaid, but in West Virginia, we have $175 million surplus in Medicaid. So it's not like anyone is going to see any cut or any program that they're currently on cut. We're taking the money from the surplus. The Republicans and Mitch Carmichael didn't want you to know that because they wanted to pit the people against the teachers. That was their one last shot at doing that.
Mm-hmm.
This is coming from the surplus. $10 million of it is coming from the surplus. The remaining amount of the money is coming from the governor's suggestion of putting money into commerce, and they're taking some of that out. So the budget will not hurt any West Virginian. This raise will not hurt any West Virginian. It will help West Virginians because it will start to help us become competitive to attract teachers into the state and service professionals into the state so that our kids can have a better education system.
Right.
We have a great education system right now, but this will allow us to build an even better one.
So let me ask you about that, because you've spoken very eloquently over the past several days about the challenge that West Virginia has in retaining its teachers, right? I mean, there's a teacher shortage, and the state's been certifying folks who may not be fully trained up to be in classrooms. But so the pay raise does do something to sort of get at that. But you still are facing this enormous gap between what West Virginia teachers are paid on average versus those in neighboring states. I mean, we've been hearing over the past several days about folks driving at half an hour across state lines and working in other districts and getting paid $20,000 more.
That's absolutely true. Now, this pay raise, while we save 5%, what it actually is, it's a $2,020 pay raise across the board. And the reason we're doing that across the board amount rather than a percent amount is because it helps the beginning teachers more. It gives them a larger percentage than it does the experienced teachers, and that's our way of starting to attract teachers into the county. We're $5,000 to $20,000 less than our contiguous states. This is the first step. This will help start, and that's why I'm saying this can't be just this one-time thing. It has to be the initial investment.
Yeah.
When you're investing for your future, you don't put money in 1 year and forget about it for the next 3 years. So that's what we're doing now. We're investing in the future of our kids in West Virginia. We put money in it now. We put money in it next year. We put money in it from that point on. And then our kids will be the winners.
You know, Dale Lee, the strike in West Virginia has caused a lot of people across the country to start asking this question, is there a crisis in teacher pay in many parts of the United States? And to that end, we actually got a comment on our website from someone named John Evergreen, who says, there is no teacher pay crises. It's a part-time job that pays a full-time living wage. If they want more money for more luxuries in life, they can earn it on a side gig during their 180 days per year off. The crisis is that there aren't enough laws with enough stiff penalties to protect good citizen taxpayers from public unions colluding to inflate and price fix wages and benefits. What's your reaction to that? We just got a minute here.
Boy, you had me on a high, and now you're trying to bring me down.
No, I'm not trying to bring you down. This is people reacting here.
I'm kidding. The reaction to that is this is not an 8-to-3 job for teachers. Teachers work continuously. They take things home. They're at ball games. They're at dances. They're doing things for the kids. They work every weekend. They're in all the time. And then in the summer, when they think we have this paid vacation, teachers are actually trying to better themselves and taking classes, doing different things to better their craft. Mm. This is not a part-time job.
Dale Lee, can you stand by? Because I want to let you finish your thought, but I got to take a quick break here. So hang on here for just a minute. We're talking about lessons from the West Virginia teacher strike. And if there is indeed a crisis in teacher pay across the country and what to do about it. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by the new CNN original series, Pope, the Most Powerful Man in History, a dramatic new 6-part series narrated by Liam Neeson that links recent news events surrounding the Vatican to their unexpected historical origins in the Catholic Church. From the start of the papacy to struggles with corruption to the challenges faced by wartime popes, go inside the Vatican to explore the roles of popes throughout history and how they spread Catholicism around the world. Pope airs Sundays at 10 p.m. Eastern on CNN.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A, a show where people gather to speak freely. You might learn something new, hear things that challenge you, and on Friday, we review the week's top stories. You'll find the 1A podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. That was the sound of jubilation inside the West Virginia State Capitol as teachers discovered that they had indeed won a 5% pay raise after a historic 9-day strike in West Virginia. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about lessons from the West Virginia teachers' strike and whether or not there is a crisis in teacher pay across the country or at least in some states in America. And more importantly, if the strike has opened our eyes to the fact that do we need to reassess, rethink, and maybe expand our notions of who's economically vulnerable in the United States, and if so, what does that mean? And with me is Dale Lee. He's president of the West Virginia Education Association. And Mr. Lee, I'm sorry I had to cut you off there because we needed to take a quick break, but you were responding to a listener comment that we had that said, you know, teachers earn enough money just fine. That listener didn't think that there's a teacher pay crisis, and therefore, you know, challenged the notion that why doesn't a teacher just get another job?
Well, hey, you're right. I did challenge that because teachers work continuously. They work all summer taking classes, taking trainings, and preparing for their kids. One of the things that I'm most proud about of our teachers here in West Virginia, as soon as we announced we were having a work action, they immediately went to their communities and their churches, and they started setting up food banks for the kids. They were providing hot lunches, hot meals for during the day. They were continuing the backpack for kids, getting food for the weekend, and they started setting up daycare centers and helping parents with daycare. They did that on their own. Our teachers and service professionals did that on their own. That's what we do all the time. Now, to think that there is a crisis for what we pay teachers, but let me ask you a question. Of all the people that who influenced you, 99% of people will think of a teacher that was a major influence in their life. I don't ever recall anyone saying this certain politician was the biggest influence in my life. Most people will think of a teacher. It's because we should be in the position, we should be paying our teachers. In the position we're in, because we shape futures, we should be paying them what we deserve, because we shape the future. When we do that, when we put the emphasis on education, and that's what I'm proud of us starting here in West Virginia, we're making the first step to an investment, and the investment in education is going to help us be an economic driver here.
Dale Lee, I've got enough time. I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but I just got enough time to ask you one more quick question here.
I get on a rant. Someone says teachers only work.
You know, on this show, everyone has a right to get on a rant, but I've also got the right to rein it in a little bit because I want to ask one more quick question. Are you hearing from teachers in other states?
Yes, we are. And what I hope we learn in West Virginia, what I hope the lesson learned from West Virginia is that their governors and their legislators will do the right thing and make the investment in education now before it gets to the point where we had to do in West Virginia.
Yeah. Well, that's Dale Lee, president of the West Virginia Education Association, speaking to us from Charleston, West Virginia. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, let's take a quick call here. Ebony is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on the air, Ebony.
Hi, Magna. I'm so glad Mr. Lee was able to get in there and kind of root for the teachers, because I, as a former teacher, can tell you that we work in and out of the off the clock. I mean, practically minimum wage. And there needs to be a complete revamp for the educational system in general. I had to leave my job because, I mean, being able to try to provide as a mother or a family for my daughter, for my son, and work as a teacher, and work as a second job, and work a day in and day out for the students who can't. I mean, you're constantly revamping your lesson plans to make sure that everyone in your class is passing, that we're all passionate about our job. Mm-hmm. So we're working around the clock. And even in the summers, I'm working around the clock to figure out how can we be better. So no. We never get a break.
But you had to leave teaching, you said? You had to leave teaching?
Yes, I did. I did leave teaching because I couldn't support my family, sustain my family with the money that I was receiving. So yes, there needs to be a complete revamp. I actually ended up starting my own business and then tutoring on the side. And I make just the same amount, which is still not, you know, a lot of money, but you know, I have the time to spend to make sure that my daughter is passing and doing the things that she needs to do in class and that my son. So it's very unfortunate to hear that people, and I can probably say that man that had made the comment about teachers not working probably doesn't have a child in school, because if you did, you'd know all of the work that we're doing.
Right. Ebony, I take your point, and thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your call. I want to turn now to Dana Goldstein. She's education reporter for the New York Times and author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession, joining us today from New York. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna.
Hi, Dana. So you've already heard just in the past couple of minutes sort of the spectrum of opinions about teachers and teacher pay and teacher unionization, to speak more broadly. What's your take on the big lesson from what's happened in West Virginia?
Yeah, I think what was really surprising about the West Virginia strike is it actually originated through social media, a Facebook group where teachers were coming together to discuss some of their grievances and what to do about it. And that's really what kicked all of this off. It wasn't a top-down movement that union leaders conceived of. It was really something that the rank and file grassroots pushed for. Another thing that's really significant about that is that the Supreme Court will soon be deciding a case that conservatives hope will really gut unions by preventing them from compelling workers to pay union dues.
Right.
But West Virginia already has that policy in place.
Right. There's no collective bargaining there, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Teachers don't have statewide collective bargaining. It's a right to work state. So sort of an anti-union climate for public sector employees like teachers. And yet still this happened there. So I think as a reporter, when I was calling people in the labor movement to ask them what they made of all this, they were saying that they're hopeful that this sort of shows a path forward, not just for teachers who are upset about their low pay, but for other workers in our economy.
Yeah. You know, so you've been looking for years now at public education as this both unifying institution, because it is public education, but also sort of divisive political institution in America. And just recently, in reporting on West Virginia, you pointed out something really interesting that I'd love to hear more of your thoughts on, and that is that the state's cost of living is roughly sort of in the middle of the pack for the United States, but median household income is on the lower side, right? And the teacher's income was matching that lower side, that lower medium. So there's this disconnect there. And I just wonder what you make of this idea, this bigger idea, that one of the things that the teacher strike has done is sort of made us rethink, well, when we're talking about working class Americans or who's economically vulnerable, that there are entire professions that we need to start considering under that umbrella.
Yeah, that's right. I think you're correct. And what's interesting about teaching is, you know, traditionally it's often a job that is a pathway into the middle class. If you grow up working class, maybe you're the first in your family to graduate college. Teaching is a choice of a profession that many people in that group make. And it is supposed to, or traditionally we think of it as a way to achieve middle class status. But as your opening to the segment revealed, there are teachers in West Virginia and other states who qualify for some public supports. Because they are not really earning enough to get by. And we know that, you know, for a century or more, really since the founding of our public education system, many teachers have had to do second or third jobs to get by. So this strike really shows something that is age old in the teaching profession, which is that teachers do ally themselves with organized labor, even though we think of unions as more of a blue-collar phenomenon. Because teacher pay doesn't always fit the sort of college-educated, intellectual, academic picture that we have of teachers' work.
Right. I mean, I feel like that's one of the big takeaways here, that there's this sense that the West Virginia action here is representing sort of I don't even think it's extreme, but the next step in this national concern about the middle class being squeezed and perhaps even squeezed out of existence if we have, you know, if we're saying that there's a crisis in the profession of teaching in terms of pay. But you know, you've also written in your book, for example, how, you know, even though there's still a lot of debate over whether or not teachers are getting paid enough or they're just fine, but that historically teacher pay in the United States has been virtually absurdly low at times.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I talk about in my piece that's in the New York Times this morning about how, why did teachers unionize in the first place? And that's because in Chicago at the turn of the 20th century, where the teachers union movement originated, teachers were earning the equivalent of $13,000 in today's dollars. At that time, teachers were 97% female, and they were really thought of as just a step up from being a maid. And they made very little money compared to a maid, just a little bit more. So teaching kind of as a job, it occupies sometimes a strange space in between the working class and the middle class. And I think what we're seeing now in an environment of scarcity where many states are seeing depleted education budgets or stagnant education budgets, teachers are feeling that in their own pocketbooks. Mm. And also students are feeling that. I mean, when I was talking to teachers in West Virginia, they were just telling me about the dire needs of the kids they work with, whether it's for healthcare or their parents are unemployed or they're affected by the very deep drug crisis, the opioid crisis in West Virginia. That makes it, you know, really interesting to continue to see where does the legislature get this money to fund this raise for teachers and other public employees. The governor did promise yesterday that it would not come from Medicaid.
Medicaid, right. He said not on this planet would that happen. Right. Dina, hang on for a second because we've got a ton of people who want to get their say in here. And I just want to at least get a couple of them in. Bruce is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. You're on the air, Bruce.
Hi, Magda. Thank you. I just wanted to mention, and I think this is in it parallels or queers with what an earlier commenter makes, but I think there's really a crisis of overall insecurity and discouragement in the teacher ranks right now. Teachers live under a situation where collective bargaining, at least in our state and other states too, has been gutted. Even though for decades we had a very good collective bargaining system, but the Iowa Republican legislature just decided to gut it. Working conditions have really deteriorated. Job insecurity has resulted from the trashing of collective bargaining. Classes are large. There's vouchers and privatization, which is a stab in the back of public school teachers. The classrooms are actually dangerous. You go into an inner city school, you go with the teacher into those situations, and you can find fights constantly and
right.
people struggling just to maintain order. So teachers without collective bargaining need to strike, and I think that's part of the lesson here.
Yeah, Bruce, can I just jump in here? I'm sorry to interrupt you here, but you make an interesting point, and I want to get that into the conversation here. Thank you so much for calling. So Bruce is bringing up this notion that in some places he believes the collective bargaining is the only way to really advocate for change here, and one of the bigger issues coming out of West Virginia is, are strikes going to happen in other states? People are looking to Arizona and Oklahoma. I mean, for example, here's Ginger Tinney, executive director of the Professional Oklahoma Educators. And she told the Oklahoma City News Station, KOCO, that teachers in their state are ready for a long overdue, in their minds, pay raise.
We're seeing a frustration building amongst teachers that were tired of being treated like second-class citizens.
All right, so let's turn now to Oklahoma City and get the view of a teacher there. Jessica Tilley joins us. She's a fifth grade teacher at Lee Elementary School. Jessica, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So are Oklahoma teachers poised to strike like they did in West Virginia?
We are ready. We have been very frustrated for a long time, and we are now all joining together to come to be united and really fight for what we deserve at this point.
Yeah. You know, I mean, so tell me about your pay and your sort of economic situation, because we've already heard some disagreement from listeners who've written in that they're not convinced that there is a teacher pay crisis.
So I graduated college 4 years ago, and I'm a single person living on my own, and I can barely make it paycheck to paycheck. You know, I want to encourage other people to get into this business, but it's hard to do that whenever I can barely live as a single person, let alone support a family or other people living in my household.
Did you ever expect this going into the teaching profession?
Not at all. I mean, I knew that you don't get into teaching for the pay, obviously, but if you can't live to support yourself, then, I mean, What future is that?
Yeah, are Oklahoma teachers? You know, the teachers in West Virginia wore red as part of their strike. Are there sort of preliminary actions like that going on now in Oklahoma?
Yes, we are meeting daily, trying to get people to support us and to hear what we're asking, like our demands. And we're trying to, you know, we're really trying to avoid the strike at all possible. We're trying to take every preemptive strategy we know, and we're still not being heard.
Yeah.
Just yesterday, you know, OEA announced that they were going to only support
us if we did it after April 23rd, which is after our testing window is closed.
Uh-huh. Interesting. One last question for you, Jessica. I mean, from your view there on the ground in Oklahoma, what do you think the consequences might be if teachers don't get some kind of pay raise in the next couple of years?
There's already been the consequences. We're already losing really well-educated teachers to other professions and other states surrounding us. We're getting, you know, emergency certified teachers in the classroom, which in turn is not, you know, educating our children as much as they need to be. So we're getting, you know, more behavior issues in the schools, which leads to less teaching because we're dealing with behavior. So, I mean, we're just going downhill very quickly if we don't get educated people into the classroom.
Right. Well, that's Jessica Tilley, fifth grade teacher at Lee Elementary School in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, where teachers are now thinking perhaps they need to go on strike as they did in West Virginia. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dana Goldstein, thanks for hanging in there with me. We've got just about 30 seconds here till the break, but what's your response to what you heard Jessica say?
It's interesting to me that nationwide, as we're talking about teachers kind of rising up to voice their dissatisfaction, this is really happening from the grassroots up. It's not the state teachers' unions that are driving this. It's just regular teachers like Jessica.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. We're talking about lessons from the West Virginia teacher strike. We've got a comment here on the website from Davian Edwards, who says, I always consider the question of how. Every constituency in government desires more funding, better roads, new technology, increased spending in all aspects of education, healthcare, and the like. West Virginia has a population of some 1.8 million people in the entire state, and most of it is rural. So exactly where would the money to provide all of these unquestionably positives come from? They simply do not have the tax base. Interesting perspective there. Let's get a couple of quick calls in here. Paul is calling from Janesville, Wisconsin. You're on the air, Paul.
Hi, Meghna.
Hi, what's your story?
Tell
me your thought.
I have two daughters that are teachers. One's a professor, spent 12 years of post high school education to get her PhD, and she doesn't get paid for the summers either. So I don't know where this guy, what prompted me to call was this guy said it was a part-time job with 180 days vacation. Then I have my youngest daughter is a high school band director, and she couldn't call me on Saturday, which was my birthday, because she was busy working.
Yeah.
So it's not a part-time job. In the summer when she's off, in order to make ends meet, she works as a waitress.
Mm-hmm. Paul, thank you so much for your call and your perspective there. I'm hearing a lot of deep feeling, and I appreciate you taking the time to call us. Let's get another call. Mira is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Mira.
Hi, Meghna. I'd like to get your guest's thoughts on why globally the teaching profession is not given the honor and prestige it deserves when we all want the best teachers for our children. I'm originally from India, and it's a serious problem there, too. I cannot imagine how someone who doesn't have any incentive would want to go in and teach in a municipal school even there. So I'm taking this into, you know, on a global level, but I'd love to get their thoughts.
So, Mira, thank you so much for your call, because actually this opens up an interesting line of questions. Dana Goldstein, education reporter for The New York Times, perfect person to answer this, because I get Mira's point, but I think there are some exceptions, right? If we look at Finland and Singapore, there teachers are paid considerably healthy salaries, and it's actually a competitive profession to get into.
Yeah, I think in nations that are able to pick the top students to become teachers, teaching is more prestigious. That is not the way we've sort of manufactured and built and architected the profession in the United States.
It's not very competitive to get into a teacher's college, for example. We don't require really high test scores to become a teacher. And so that has led to some lack of prestige. Then again, it is a mass profession. We do need over 3 million people to do the job in this giant nation of ours. And so there can be some tension between trying to make it prestigious and more academically competitive and attracting the mass number of people we need to the job. I think another reason historically, and this is international as well, why teaching is not as respected as perhaps it should be is because it is just an overwhelmingly female profession. And in the United States, about 75% of teachers are female still today. Some people are surprised to hear that. And I think because teachers spend their day with kids, sometimes we don't give them and the job the respect that it does deserve. And we sort of see teachers as kind of maybe using their nurturing skills as opposed to using their intellectual skills. But both parts of the job are equally important, as any teacher would tell you.
But isn't that one of the sort of the tension points in education? Because, you know, almost virtually in the same paragraph, we hear people say, well, we have to educate our kids to the best of their ability because, you know, they are the future. But then in the second line of a comment, the same person might say, but a 5% pay raise is unreasonable.
Yeah, I mean, I think teachers are often blamed for everything that isn't working in our school system. And beyond that, they're blamed for what isn't working in society. So when we talk about a problem like kids not being prepared for the workforce, we're expecting teachers to shoulder that burden, but we're not paying teachers what they should be paid. So are we getting the best people into the profession? It's a vicious, vicious cycle. And if you look at a state like West Virginia, you know, teachers there are telling me, I'm dealing with a drug crisis. I'm dealing with kids that come to school wearing shorts in the wintertime. I have to bring food from home to feed my kids. So when teachers are doing all these other things because we have such a frayed social safety net, it can become hard for them to focus on what I think they probably ought to be focusing on, which is the academic part of their job, the mentoring part of their job.
But, you know, I think I should have said this earlier, and so I'm remiss in not pointing this out. When we're talking about teacher pay, though, because of the way education, as you pointed out a bit ago, is structured in America, it varies widely from state to state, right? We've been focusing on the states in which teacher pay is particularly low, but New York, California, Massachusetts, median pay for teachers in those states is north of $70,000. So it's not as if there is a nationwide crisis here.
Right. I mean, it depends on how you think about it. The average teacher pay nationwide is about $60,000 per year. In some parts of the nation, that's really great. In some parts of the nation, it's not so great. Teachers generally have to work a very, very long time to achieve peak pay. So a teacher may have a decent starting salary at 23, but 10 years later at 33, they're making a lot less than other college-educated professionals. So there's all sorts of pay reforms that could make the profession more attractive, not just, raises necessarily, but maybe restructuring the way the pay is doled out so that teachers don't have to wait, 20 or 30 years to achieve peak pay, but they can be rewarded a little earlier on when they're making decisions about whether to buy a home or start a family.
Ultimately, Dana Goldstein, do you think that what happened in West Virginia is the start of something that we're likely to see more of? I mean, I know the immediate attention is probably now in Oklahoma and Arizona, but if there is indeed this sort of bubbling up of a consciousness that there's this new group of people who are feeling incredibly economically vulnerable, could we be seeing more strikes like this in surprising places?
Well, it's definitely the question we're asking this morning on the national desk of the New York Times where I work. And so I'm going to be spending the rest of my day making phone calls, trying to figure that out to see if this really is a national movement. I mean, we know that there's just been an uptick in protest in this country over the past year or so in general. A lot of the teachers I've spoken to have been inspired by movements like the Women's March, like Black Lives Matter, like Me Too.
So if teachers are kind of feeling energized from some of those other movements and also feeling angry because of the conditions that we've been talking about this hour, then certainly we could see a national movement arise here.
Well, Dana Goldstein is education reporter for The New York Times, author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, we've had a lot of activity on social media here, too. On Twitter, Brett Mills says, as a former teacher who worked roughly 55 to 60 hours a week during my time in the classroom, I'd happily pay more in taxes if it meant teachers could get a well-deserved raise, anything to get them more support. Paula Nagode, hopefully I said your name right, Paula, said, we teach 180 days and have professional development and continuing education while we are, quote, off for the summer. So keep sending us your comments on Twitter or Facebook at On Point or at our website, On Point Radio. OnPointRadio.org, I should say. In a moment, the talk of a brain drain at the White House. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Well, moving on to Washington, Gary Cohn, President Trump's chief economic advisor, is the latest key figure to leave the White House. The wave of major departures has raised concerns of a coming brain drain in the West Wing. And joining me now from New York is Jonathan Lemire, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Jonathan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So a brain drain. Tell me more about what people are talking about.
Well, Gary Cohn, who was the president's chief economic advisor, is just the latest senior staffer to leave this White House. The Brookings Institution, a think tank based in Washington, has a study where they track senior-level staff departure. The analysis there is that the Trump departure rate is nearly 40%, which is more than double any other administration has had during the same time in their term. And there is, you know, we have seen this pace seem to accelerate in recent weeks. Last week, of course, Hope Hicks, who was the president's, not just his communications director, but also in many ways his closest ally and advisor, you know, someone who is rarely more than a shout away from the Oval Office, someone who has been there since the very, very beginning of his campaign. She left. And now we have Gary Cohn also leave. You know, he's someone who has had a very up and down arc in the Trump White House, nearly resigning last summer over after the racial violence in Charlottesville, Virginia. He was very upset with the president, saying there was blame on both sides of that white supremacist march and the resulting death, you know, to someone who then went back up in the president's eyes after he successfully shepherded the tax cut late last year. And in fact, just a few weeks ago, when Chief of Staff John Kelly seemed like he might be on the way out, Gary Cohn was even floated as a replacement. But yet here we are, just a couple weeks later, he's leaving after disagreeing with the president's policy on tariffs.
Right. And so there's also been kind of people are wondering about H.R. McMaster as National Security Advisor and how long he might hang on. What do we know about that?
Yes, H.R. McMaster has been someone who has survived a number of attacks over the months. Members of the right wing, sort of fairly conservative, sort of the fringes of the conservative movement, have very publicly targeted him. There was a wave last summer suggesting that he was not sufficiently supportive of Israel, and that was one reason they wanted him out. We do know that H.R. McMaster at times has clashed with the president over policy. He and Defense Secretary Mattis do not always see eye to eye. To this point, McMaster is still in the White House. He is still in his position. But yes, there are a number of aides in the building who think he could be the next to go. And it also speaks to just a larger point of not only is morale really low in the building right now with this flood of departures with a Russia probe hanging overhead, but there's also real concern about what the difficulties this administration has had to find replacements.
Right.
They're having trouble bringing people into the administration.
Right. I mean, in your reporting, multiple aides who spoke to you on conditions of anonymity basically said that they were thinking about leaving but didn't have a clue whom the administration could find to fill their roles.
That's right. I mean, this is, first of all, the administration has been understaffed from the get-go. Some of that is because of turmoil during the transition. You might recall Chris Christie was actually in charge of the transition until the president then the president-elect actually won, and then suddenly the keys were turned over to Mike Pence. So that sort of put them behind the eight ball. They've had trouble bringing people in who did not want to perhaps work for President Trump, and as the months have gone on, who have not wanted the legal exposure of coming into this White House while it is under such investigation. And within the White House, the president has refused to consider a lot of people who opposed him, Republicans, like Republicans with significant establishment credentials he doesn't want in because they didn't back him during the primaries or during the general election. So they've had real trouble finding qualified people to come in. Senior staffers, other aides, key aides in the White House who have stayed, you know, out of a sense of loyalty to country, even if not always the president himself, you know, even they are wondering now how much longer they can hang on.
Mm-hmm. So what effect is this having on the actual functioning of the White House? Because you cite an example, Johnny DeStefano, who oversees White House, who oversees the following White House offices: personnel, public liaison, political affairs, and intergovernmental affairs. One person looking over four offices. Highly unusual, to say the least. I mean, what effect is that having on how the White House is actually able to function in its daily duties?
Mick Mulvaney, the budget director, also has a couple of different jobs
right now. Right.
Yes, it is difficult. There are people who are overwhelmed, who can't give their full attention to one job because they're doing several. And on the lack of staffing combined with the often mixed messaging from the Oval Office has led to this administration having a hard time getting its policy in place. They have had, yes, a few successes, the tax cut chief among them, but a number of other things have stalled out, have just not gone anywhere. We'll see if the president is able to push forward the tariff thing later this week.
Okay. And do we know how the president feels about all of this? Because, you know, you quote him as having said that he likes conflict and he knows that he's a tough boss to work for.
This is a president who we routinely have to fact check. We do not need to fact check the statement, "I like conflict." I think we all recognize that that is true. And that has been his leadership style throughout, from his business career to the campaign to the White House, where he likes to have aides with differing viewpoints. He likes to kind of let them have at it. And then he then will make a decision based off of that disagreement, which side he buys. We saw him yesterday in the White House talk about how he doesn't mind turnover, that he's insisting that they will have good people come in, that he has no shortage of qualified applicants. That's not necessarily true, as our reporting indicates. Right now he is, of course, publicly is saying this is okay. He doesn't mind this, you know, if you will, team of rivals. But the evidence is in the policy, and we're not seeing much of it, and that's in part because of the constant staff turnover.
Right. I mean, and the president did sort of, in a tongue-in-cheek way, perhaps acknowledge the conflict or troubles in the White House at the gridiron dinner on Saturday. I mean, in your reporting, you remind us that he compared the Oval Office job to The Apprentice, and he said, "In one job, I had to manage a cutthroat cast of characters desperate for TV time, totally unprepared for their roles and their jobs, and each week afraid of having their blank fired. And the other job, I was the host of a smash television hit." Okay, so good for a laugh, but is it good for the country necessarily, Jonathan?
Perhaps not. Yes, we are seeing a similar turnover rate to The Apprentice, where it seems like a key cast member leaves every week. It's hard for any White House to function with that level of instability, to not know who is doing what, to not have experienced veteran people in there managing specific portfolios. You know, this is something that the Chief of Staff Kelly had tried to get a handle on in recent months. I think some progress is made, but there's still friction in the building.
Yep.
Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump still have somewhat ill-defined roles.
Jonathan, I got to take it back from you because the list could go on. Jonathan LeMire, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Thank you so much. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. We'll be right back.